This episode of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 8th of July 2012 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly, episode 157, with me, Hugo MacDonald, and Sophie Grove.
Coming up on the show, we'll be talking to Clive Stafford Smith, the human rights lawyer and anti-death penalty campaigner who's arguing for reform in the US justice system.
We'll also be seeking out lost art with Tate Britain's Jennifer Mundy. Her new project tells the stories behind missing masterpieces.
And we'll be joined by author Andrew Bloom, whose new book seeks out the physical nuts and bolts holding together the most intangible of life essentials. The internet.
And of course, we'll be enjoying some great music too. That's right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Hello, Sophie.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thank you. Welcome right back at you.
It's been a big week in Midori House as we've put to bed Monocle Mediterraneo.
It was fun, wasn't it?
Well, it was. It saw us all off on various jaunts around the Mediterranean to just not go on holiday, but to find out...
I love the way you're just making that on record, even though you were in Sardinia, in a lovely holiday resort.
Well, I couldn't possibly list the number of places that you've been to. I mean, you really did take in most of the Mediterranean, didn't you?
What I loved, my trip, I left the office and I sort of skirted the Mediterranean. So I went to Beirut, then I flew to Italy, to Rome, then I went up to the north of Italy. And then I was off again to Marseille in the south of France. And it was all more or less in one sort of grand tour.
Grand tour swoop. Are you very well educated now then on all that delights in the Mediterranean?
It was like a room with a view, really. a little bit less sort of pleasantries, it has to be said. I was tearing around reporting on various different things on the Syrian border up there, and then also an amazing music festival that's taking place despite all the troubles, and then a really interesting story in Italy about an American base, which was really fantastic.
And in amongst all of this very hard work, did you manage a dip in the big sea itself?
I did. I swam in Marseille. It's really quite something. It's big. It's so windy. It's kind of a port city. And you have to sort of dive off the rocks. It's a bit like Sydney, I kept on saying to people's absolute astonishment, because it's got that feeling of people kind of swimming before and after work. They're kind of doing bay to bay laps, kind of, and there's these amazing swimming clubs. It's a really great swimming culture in Marseille, and there's a really lovely feeling of that urban beach. Or rocky, urban sort of
wonderful
and pontoon kind of thing.
You're a big fan of outdoor swimming. You've even written an essay asking to bring back the Lidos, I think.
I have. I even spoke to the mayor of Marseille about swimming. So I think I've done my bit for Lidos in this issue.
Fantastic. Well, that is out in a couple of weeks and you can read all about all of our various adventures in that. But first, let's talk to Clive Stafford Smith.
Though supposedly leaders of the free world, the US justice system seems as vulnerable as any when it comes to bureaucratic and political forces interfering in the courtroom. The lengthy appeals process can lead to cases such as that of the British citizen Chris Maharaj, the millionaire businessman who spent 25 years on death row for a crime that his lawyer, the human rights specialist Clive Stafford Smith, OBE, says he did not commit. In a new book, Injustice, Clive chronicles his campaign to free Maharaj, and he joins us now in the studio. Clive, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Hi.
Can you tell us about Chris's story? I mean, the book is a very arresting and incredibly sort of vivid explanation.
I should point out that I've obviously paid you large amounts.
No, you haven't. It's really, it is a really very, the courtroom is described very vividly and his story is described so interestingly. And I wanted to, if you could tell us about his story and how he ended up on death row.
Well, I should say first that in your introduction, it was set in the past tense. Unfortunately, Chris is still in prison and indeed he's not eligible for parole until he's 101 years old, by which time he'll be dead. He was sentenced to death, and I guess the jury had every reason to do it because the evidence against him seemed quite strong. It was a sensational case in the DuPont Plaza Hotel in downtown Miami. And the prosecution said that they had an eyewitness who had passed a lie detector who was there with him and watched him kill Derek and Dwayne Mooyoung, a father and son, who supposedly he had had some business fracas with, and he had a motive because they owed him lots of money. They'd been spreading all sorts of bad things about him in the local media. And according to the chief detective, he'd said he never had a gun. There was evidence he did have a gun of apparently the type used in the murder. He said he'd never been in the room. There were fingerprints all over the room. So what the jury heard was pretty powerful, that clearly, according to the government witnesses, he was lying. And the defense didn't exist. There was no defense put on. I got involved some years later, 8 years after Chris had been sentenced to death. And as you mentioned, he was once a millionaire. In fact, he bought two horses off my dad before both he and my dad went bankrupt. And by the time I met him, he was bankrupt and had no right to a lawyer under the American system. And so I ended up representing him.
So tell us about how you met him and came to find out about him. And was that the connection that you just alluded to, or was that something completely different?
No, not at all. In fact, I didn't find that out till years later. But no, it was the British consulate called me up. I was in Atlanta at the time, said there was this British guy in trouble. And I was in Florida the next week or so, and so I went to see him. And I have a terribly hard time saying no when he asked if I'd help him. But it's been the most traumatic and fascinating case. I mean, I've represented him now for 18 years, and frankly, I've failed him. He's still in prison. But over those 18 years, we've discovered all sorts of things. And the reason I wrote the book was because he's still there, and he's innocent, and he needs help. And also, I was trying to understand how on earth could I have failed him when the evidence we developed was so powerful. Just to give you a soupçon, we discovered that the two victims, far from being these innocent little people they were portrayed at the time of trial, had in their briefcase evidence that they were trying to buy a bank for $600 million in Manuel Noriega's Panama. They were trying to buy gems for $94 million, and they were laundering money around the Caribbean to the tune of $5 billion. And, they were meant, according to the prosecution, to be business people on £15,000 a year. Then we discovered that right across the hall from where the murders took place on the 12th floor of the DuPont Plaza is a guy called Jaime Vallejo Mejia, who was from Pereira, Colombia. As an aside, I was amused that Miami had twinned with Pereira as a twin city. I mean, they had to be doing some dope at the time they voted for that. But it turns out this guy, Mejia, was wanted at the time for laundering $40 million in cash himself. We were able to show that the police officer lied about what he said about Chris and the gun. Chris always admitted he had a gun. It had been stolen before the crime, so he couldn't have used it. The police officer lied about everything else Chris said, effectively. And the eyewitness who said Chris was clearly guilty failed the polygraph test. He didn't pass it. And Chris had six alibi witnesses putting him somewhere else at the time of the crime. And that's just a little sort of Reader's Digest version. I'm afraid you're going to have to plow through hundreds of pages to get the full story.
And the book is written in a sort of crime thriller style, in a way. And from what you just described, it really does sort of have all the components of a thriller like that, except that it's real.
Well, it's the sort of rubbish I read as thrillers, so that's what I write, obviously.
But isn't it? Is it a decision that you've made as a writer to write it in that sort of genre?
Well, let's not overdo it. I'm not sure I qualify as a writer, but I like that genre. I think I get very bored with books that are just sort of dry and theoretical. And Chris's case is a thriller. It's a depressing thriller for him. But, you know, one of the fascinating things about capital cases, and I've done well over 300, is they are so bizarre. And if you wrote them as novels, people would think you're on something.
Clive, I want to ask there, you mentioned you've done over 300 cases. Sort of, how do you switch off from these? You've mentioned a few times that you feel like you've failed Chris.
Why on earth would you want to switch off?
I mean, how do you sleep at night?
Well, I sleep at night with the help of sleeping pills, probably. But no, it's that, let's not get it wrong. We win a vast majority of the cases that we take as the charity I work with, Reprieve. And, you know, 98% of them. So that's huge. And frankly, if I had the choice of being a banker, where I would throw myself off the top of the building, or doing something that's really a joy every day where you give people's lives back to them. I'd far rather choose the latter. But Chris's case is an example of where, you know, there's this terrible dissonance where I know, to the extent a human being can know, that he's innocent, and yet the system says he's guilty.
And in the book, I mean, in the opening, you describe the prosecutor in his trial, and he does seem like somebody who's really determined to pin this on Chris. I mean, that's his job. But I wondered whether the characters you work with and the other lawyers that you work with, is it difficult in the US when you're working and the actual result of what you do is someone's life or death?
Well, I think it's the same thing if you've got one life and you're banged up for life in prison, frankly. But the thesis of the book is more what finally came to me, and I sort of kicked myself that for years of doing this, I didn't work this out before, that almost everyone's in the wrong job. So you talk about the prosecutor. Obviously, people going to work every day as prosecutors aren't driving along saying, oh, how many innocent people will I bang up today? So, you know, a study of American prosecutors shows that more than half of them think the presumption of innocence is nonsense, that obviously these guys are all guilty, and so they come at it with an absolute certainty of guilt. And that's not because they're bad people, that's just because of who they are. And so we're picking people who are predisposed to make mistakes, because they'll never admit they did make a mistake because they just don't believe it. I had a guy, not Chris, another guy in Louisiana, where we had 6 DNA tests to prove it wasn't my guy but someone else. And they were all DNA tests done by the prosecution, and they still wouldn't believe they had the wrong guy. So, you know, if you want to have a system where we don't make mistakes, you're going to have commie pinko liberals like you probably on as prosecutors who'll...
I'll take that as a compliment.
You should. I view that as myself. Yeah, but people who are going to think, oh my goodness, I might make a mistake. I've got to be really careful here. You know, perhaps I'm wrong. Those are the people you actually want to be prosecutors and police. But in fact, we choose very different people, or perhaps they self-select into that job. And that's why the system is predestined to make mistakes.
Do you think that's why the US... you know, this wonderful democratic society still has the death penalty, that mentality you just described? Or is it something else? Is it politics? Is it the society? Is it that mentality?
Well, this book's about America primarily, but I'm half English and half American. And frankly, most of the same rules apply in this country, in Britain. It's just we don't have the death penalty. But if you think about our attitude, for example, towards pedophiles, you know, if you took a poll of British people, they'd want to do all sorts of awful things to pedophiles, even though I've represented a bunch, and there's really no such thing as a pedophile who isn't seriously mentally ill. You know, I have a 3-year-old child, and people who want to do things to him are obviously ill. So we all societies have their hatreds, and it's perhaps dangerous for us to pick too much on the Americans.
So I wondered... now you've written this book, and it is in this very engaging and entertaining format. You've looked at some other films and that are about your work in the sense that the Americans seem to be very fascinated by being entertained by the drama of the death penalty. Do you think that that's something that's in their culture? Does it reflect on why they still have it there?
Well, it's in British culture too. When you're trying a case in an American court, which is great fun, I've tried a lot of capital cases, and when I say great fun, it's a bit of a responsibility, certainly, but it's still really interesting to deal with jurors, because, you know, you have to get on the jury. I'll ask you two. Are either of you firmly in favor of the death penalty?
Yes,
no.
No?
No. See, I told you, you're a commie pinko liberal. You couldn't be on the jury in an American capital case. You were automatically struck off it, right? So that means the only people who can be on it are people who swear up and down that they will consider imposing the death penalty on my client sitting next to me. And what's so interesting about those folk is they've still got some real decency in them. And the issue is how to find that. And everyone does. And I don't imply that somehow people in favor of the death penalty are indecent. Of course not. But everyone has good in them. And what I love about the trials is finding that and getting them to come to the right conclusion for my client.
Do you enjoy the drama of the US court? Is that why you've worked there for 16 years rather than here?
I worked there for 26 years, and I'm back in Britain partly because, while I enjoyed it, it's terrifying. And I was so glad that I managed to escape America into a much quieter world here in England without any of the people I represented at trial on death row, because that's the real horror. You know, when you've represented someone from the beginning and the jury comes back and says that guy is so worthless we want to kill him, then you've really failed. And I didn't do Chris's original trial, so psychologically I can sort of blame it on actually the fairly useless trial lawyer who did nothing to defend him and didn't put on his alibi. But I'm kind of grateful that my life is no longer dictated by that.
Sorry, this sounds maybe a bit mawkish, but you just mentioned there about people that you're so grateful that you don't have to have any contact with, because presumably...
No, it's not contact. No. It's that I didn't put him on death row.
Okay.
Well, I don't like having contact with judges because they order you around in a way that's really irritating. I was sitting around a table one day and we were discussing when to set a trial in a capital case, and the judge went around everyone's vacations, you know, when you're going on holiday. And I announced when I was going on holiday, so all the other people, the other lawyers for the prosecution, the secretaries, the court reporters. And so he set the trial for my holiday, because that's how they treat the defense. And it's really annoying, and I hate that. So I'm grateful I don't have to deal with those people. But no, my clients, I that's the best part of the job, is the people that one represents and finding the humanity in people that everyone hates.
And you've worked also quite famously with Guantanamo Bay prisoners as well, and quite
it's
successfully.
The word you're searching for, notoriously. I don't know about famously.
Notoriously. what's the experience like there? I mean, how does
it's
that differ?
It's a direct translation. And the thing about death row and that is America has a terrible crime problem. I've been held up seven times at gun or knife point. And, you know, not you guys here in London probably don't get held up a lot, although if you go off and do stuff in Ethiopia, you might. But there's this terrible crime problem, and we want to pretend to solve it by having the death penalty. And then along comes this awful thing in 9/11, and suddenly we have a different group we want to hate, which is a group of Muslim people with beards. And in order to prove that we're doing something, we put them on an island. We deny them any legal rights. We deny them anything. We don't let lawyers even go see them. And then we say how hateful they all are. And in fact, over the years, I've represented people there now since, you know, a few days after it was opened. And we've proven a good 85% of them are not guilty of what Donald Rumsfeld said they did. So, you know, that's, to me, the key to all of this, is that when we put a group of people in a place and hate them and say they're the cause of all evil, we're almost always wrong.
Do you believe in incarceration in any circumstances, or are you...
That is a way longer conversation than we have time for. But I suspect, to be fair to you, I suspect I could get you to admit that you don't, if we just had a little time to talk it through. But let's not get to utopia yet. You know, what we're dealing with is the real world. And what we have to ask ourselves is, if ideally we wouldn't have prisons, then why is it our politicians say that to make the world a better place, we need more prisons? That's self-evidently wrong. Now, we won't achieve an ideal world anytime this week or next, but I think we can at least know what we're aiming for.
And with the Guantanamo Bay prisoners that you spent so much time with, I was interested to know whether or not you think there is a legacy, and how the brutality and the torture there has affected you know, contemporary societies and those people. I mean, do you think that they radicalised people in prison and made innocent people into possible threats?
I always loved the idea that people are recidivists out of Guantanamo Bay, because the vast majority of them didn't do anything in the first place, so they can't be recidivists. But interestingly, the vast majority, again, don't get radicalised. And indeed, Britain has the best record on this. One of my clients, Mosen Beg, a wonderful guy, has the record for, I think, having the only conviction since he got out, and that was for speeding. And of the other 17, no one's done anything. So I think that's a huge tribute to the individuals involved. The far bigger impact of Guantanamo has been how it's radicalized the world. So it's radicalized people outside Guantanamo. And a CIA agent said back in 2004 that for every prisoner we have in there, we've inspired 10 people to want to blow up the West. Well, that figure is hugely more today. So these decisions that politicians make as populist nonsense that are meant to sort of show us that we're doing something tough against extremism actually do exactly the opposite, whether it's Abu Ghraib, whether it's Guantanamo, whether it's the Iraq War, whether it's drones in Pakistan. All of those policies cause far more harm than good.
How politicized do you think that the judicial system is in the US?
Oh, it's hugely politicized. I mean, judges are elected for the most part in state courts, which is another massive flaw in the system, that there aren't many judges who run on a platform of, oh, let's be fair to criminals. I was in the Deep South when there was a big, rather vitriolic campaign between two judges, each of whom was swearing up and down that they would execute more people, and one was saying that the failure to execute a particular person was evidence of the total weakness of that judge. So, of course, it's politicized. Yeah.
What about the What about the UK?
Well, the UK, there are lots of interesting things. I mean, it's a mistake to say everything is cut from the same cloth, but it is interesting to look at the UK Supreme Court and ask yourself how many, I love the word minorities when you talk about women as a minority since you're a majority, but there's only been one woman on the Supreme Court of the UK of any, you know, before it was called the House of Lords, but there's only been one woman in the last 1,000 years, and the number of minorities is very, very small. So we have real problems with the representative nature of the courts.
Clive Stafford-Smith, thank you very much for joining us on The Weekly, and your new book, Injustice, Life and Death in the Courtrooms of America, is out now. And we're going to have a song. This is Freedom and Its Owner by Kings of Convenience.
That was Freedom and Its Owner by Kings of Convenience. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. The stories behind some of the world's most treasured artworks are vital to their meaning. But what about the works that have disappeared from view? Be that through theft, damage, or just not so careful owners. For lost art, the stories are all that remain. Now the Tate Gallery has launched an online exhibition, The Gallery of Lost Art, that aims to put missing masterpieces back in the public eye. We're joined now by Jennifer Mundy, Head of Collection Research at Tate. Jennifer, thank you very much for coming into the Monocle Weekly.
It's my pleasure.
Maybe you could start by telling us where the idea for the exhibition came from.
Well, we wanted to focus on the idea of lost art and how it affects our understanding of modern and contemporary art. I think people are really used to the idea that art of ancient times might have disappeared, been lost through war or fires or looting or earthquakes. But we're not so familiar with the idea that art that's relatively recent could have disappeared and still be significant and still, as it were, leave a hole in our understanding of the historical record.
And the way the website is sort of laid out, you have split it up into tables of sort of different mishaps that have happened to various works of art, be they sort of desecrated or rejected or sort of burnt or just lost or stolen, and also artists as well. Maybe you could talk through how sort of the structure came about for the site.
Well, we chose 40 stories, and that is, of course, just the tip of a huge iceberg. And so in choosing the stories, we really focused on artworks which were significant. I wanted people, if they spent time reading about these artworks, thinking about the evidence, to understand why it matters or to feel sorry in some way that the works don't still exist. So we chose significant works of art, but we also chose stories that illustrated the different ways in which art can be lost. It was vulnerable to loss. So each of the stories has a point to it that the others don't repeat.
And you're going to be updating the site with a different story each week, is that right?
That's right. We've launched with just over 20, and we're going to be adding a new table each week for the next 6 months. So we're encouraging people to come back to the site. And in our press and our publicity, we'll be focusing on the different stories that we add to the site.
Is there sort of an argument for saying that if something is accidentally destroyed or destroyed sort of even on purpose, that it's we sort of look back with nostalgia and maybe appreciate the artwork more than we would have done if it hadn't been?
I think there's certainly some works have become famous because they have been lost. They some of them have acquired mythic status in the art world in particular, but most of them actually struggle to be remembered. I think the majority of works that are lost, history moves on, people's attention moves on, and without the fact or the material essence of the work there to talk about, to respond to, there is a real risk that most of the works of art that are lost will be forgotten. Well, certainly that the story of how you remember them will be transposed, not from a one-to-one encounter with the object. It will be moved from that to looking at books or records or literary accounts. And that's a different thing.
So the project is sort of as much about keeping these artworks sort of in people's minds as sort of talking about the notion of loss of art.
And as I was working on it, I was thinking that this is a perfect project for this particular period when the internet is available and that all of us can do an amazing amounts of research through using search engines to find out scraps of information about objects in ways that would have been incredibly difficult 10, 20 years ago. You would have had to have been a scholar going to various research depositories, various libraries around the world to pull together this information. And so I think it's very much a project for our time.
Some would say that was a good or a bad thing. But Jennifer, I'm going to ask you more about the internet after a song. This is Now There Is Nothing by Hot Chip. That was Now There Is Nothing by Hot Chip from their new album In Our Heads. And we are joined still by Jennifer Mundy, Head of Collection Research at Tate, to take us through the Gallery of Lost Art. And Jennifer, before the song, we were talking a little bit about the internet. And I wanted to ask you what your experience is of hosting an online exhibition compared to a physical exhibition, because in many ways you sort of have to start from scratch in training people who are visiting the site to think of it as an exhibition, somewhere where they want to spend time rather than just click through and sort of digest instantly.
You're right. I mean, that was one of our big challenges. How could you create and curate an online exhibition? We could have just used images and text, flat text, and you could have just clicked on an image and read some text, and it would have been very much the same as any other website you'd visited. But what we wanted to do was to try and replicate that experience of going to a real exhibition, as it were, in a museum or a gallery, and going into a space. So on this website, when you click through enter, you click enter and you go into this space, it's like a grey warehouse space. And it's very clearly a special space. There's rather atmospheric lighting, there's actually a soundtrack. And when you're in the space, you see other people people standing by these tables. So you've got a sense that it's a public space and that people are doing things in the space. In the same way that when you go around a gallery, and using your cursor keys, you can navigate, you can wander among the tables and stop at something that particularly interests you. On the tables are, there's always a really quite large image of the lost work of art. But next to it are different sorts of images, often arranged as piles of research materials. So what the website team did is they took the basic image and then represented it as if it was, for example, a photocopy of a press clipping. And there might be some, and put them inside folders, research folders. So you have the sense of being in almost a working archive, a working library, as much as a gallery space. And these things are laid out on the table in a way which quite fairly casually, which that encourages you to click on them and explore what's in that pile of images. Hopefully you'll be led by your eyes, in the same way that you would be in an art exhibition. So your curiosity will lead you to explore the materials. On the tables are sometimes a laptop, and if you were to hover your cursor over the laptop, a newly commissioned film would play. So there's some rather nice...
Computers within computers.
Yes. but basically, it's an idea that you are in a real type of space, as you would be in a proper exhibition.
And you should say, I've just been hovering my cursor here in the studio and your voice pops up sometimes.
Yes, I'm sorry about that.
I wanted to ask you, though, out of all these different works, do you have any specific story or piece that you really feel is one of the greatest losses to the art world that you could talk about?
Well, perhaps the most famous, and I think everyone would probably agree on this one, is going to be Duchamp's fountain, the urinal that he exhibited in 1917 and then didn't take enough care of or couldn't be bothered to keep. Anyway, the original work of art just disappeared very, very quickly, and no one knows how. And it's amazing that no one knows how, that it was never recorded how it was lost. But we only know about this work through a photograph. But it became famous, and it changed the story of, changed the course of modern art history in many, many ways. Not least the idea that if an artist says a shop-bought piece of plumbing is a work of art, then it is a work of art. And that idea was so potent, and it really was just transformative. But the irony is, of course, we just don't have the original. What we think we were familiar with that work of art, but only because Duchamp authorised a series of replicas to be made in 1964. And we sometimes confuse the replica, the modern, more modern replicas, with the original.
But does it matter if it's a replica if it's a ready-made?
I think the fact that it was lost for so many decades added to the mystique and the importance of the concept of loss, and whether it mattered whether or not you had the material object at all. So I think in terms of answering the question, what's really the most important or the most significant work of art, I'd point to Duchamp. But there are many different examples given through the site that range across the century. We have some at the very beginning of the century, some in the middle years, quite a few from the 60s and 70s, and then even some more much more recent.
Jennifer Mundy, Head of Collection Research at Tate, and the lady behind the Gallery of Lost Art, which will be online for a year. Thank you very much for joining us on the Monocle Weekly. We're going to take a short break, and after that we're sticking with the internet, but we're going to be finding out about the nuts and bolts behind it. Stay tuned.
The internet. Quite simply, we now use it for everything, be that checking out friends' photos, calling the other side of the world, or sometimes overthrowing the odd government too. The internet is the most powerful communication tool in the world. But who actually keeps it running? Where's the engine? What do you do if it needs replacing? These questions have been answered by our next guest, Andrew Bloom, whose next book... new book, rather, Tubes Behind the Scenes at the Internet, looks at the physical infrastructure that keeps the world online. Andrew, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
It's great to be here.
So tell us, how did you start in this epic project? What was the kind of germ of the idea for this book?
Well, I was writing mostly about architecture, about buildings, but I realized over the last several years that I was spending all of my time sitting in front of my laptop screen. And even more so, when I got an iPhone, I was then getting up and looking at the smaller screen that I carried around in my pocket. And that seemed like a strange way of engaging with the physical world. And then this strange thing happened. My internet broke, and the cable guy came to fix it. And he followed the cable from behind my couch out to this big jumble behind my building. And there was a squirrel running along the wire. And he said, I think that's your problem. I think a squirrel is chewing on your internet. And this seemed preposterous because the internet, again, is this thing that causes revolutions and has transformed our lives in so many ways. It's not something a squirrel chews on. It's the transcendent idea. But in fact, it seemed a squirrel had chewed on this piece of the internet. And I thought that if a squirrel could chew on this piece of the internet, there must be other pieces that squirrels could chew on. And I had this image of sort of yanking the cable from the wall. How far could I follow it? You know, could you actually go and visit the internet if you kept following that cable?
It's a wonderful image of you as a sort of Wizard of Oz moment,
you're
looking down.
Up the broken cable and scratching your head.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I mean, there is this notion that the internet is this kind of ephemeral, sort of cloud-like entity. Is that completely wrong, or are people right in a sense that there is no physical infrastructure that you can really pin down in the way you can other tools?
Well, I like to think of it in three ways. You know, when there's the logical realms, when we load a web page and it comes on our screen, there are sort of 1,000 processes happening behind the scenes based on these algorithms and protocols and bits and zeros and ones. But in addition to that, there's this sort of physical world of the internet, what the machines actually are, and there's this geographic world, where they are and how all the pieces fit together in real places. And if the logical is very difficult for us to understand and does seem very magical, the physical and geographic are much more, you know, this is the world we have always navigated, you know, since we were children. This is a world that we can access and listen to and smell and touch and visit.
Andrew, when you've done all this research and you've discovered that actually there's so much that's physical that keeps the internet going and online, does it make you feel sort of more predisposed to sort of trusting the web, or making you think actually, you know, there's so much that can go wrong and there's so much that can be controlled by switches here and there that, you know, it's not quite the sort of big, exciting sort of thing of progress that we all think it might be?
I certainly do have a sort of more of a kind of steampunk vision of what the internet is than most people, I imagine. But I also have a bit of Stockholm syndrome. I've kind of fallen in love with my network engineer captors. And I believe in the network they've built. So I have a lot of faith in what they've done. You know, for the most part, the internet does work. And I recognize the sort of work they put into that and the deliberateness and redundancy that they've created with the network. So I trust the internet.
Can you go to the internet? I mean, is there a place that you would call the kind of absolute sort of hub that where this whole amazing World Wide Web comes from? And can you describe, if you can go there, what's it like?
Yeah. There are about a dozen buildings in the world that are by far the most important buildings of the internet, because they are the places where more networks of the internet physically connect to each other than anywhere else. So, for example, one of the most important is in London. It's a building called Telehouse. And it is a building filled with wires. So you have the router of one network, a Google or a Facebook connected, a router being a sort of big refrigerator-sized machine with blinking lights and yellow cables coming out of it, connected physically by one of those yellow cables to the router of another network, maybe a BT or Virgin or a TalkTalk or whatever it is. And if when we load a web page on our screen, that all happens automatically, you know, the process seems immediate. It's only because two network engineers have spent some time together, had a couple beers, decided that the other one is clueful, which is the opposite of clueless, and decided that they should connect their two networks and then sort of consummate that decision physically by literally plugging in one network to another in the place where they both are. And the place where they both are is almost always one of these most important buildings, whether Telehouse here in London or 60 Hudson Street in New York or One Wilshire in Los Angeles.
And what are the people like? I mean, it's quite interesting, even when you think of Wikipedia, apparently, you know, the people who sort of put together Wikipedia are sort of predominantly men in their 20s with PhDs who are really busy and committed to doing it. Is there a kind of, you know, sort of stereotypical figure that you could think of who works in this area that we're talking about?
Well, there are often men who are 42 because they all started, you know, basically 20 years ago with the internet. And they are the prototypical geeks, and they're very proud of that. But there's a little twist at the sort of top. The kind of the best of them are not just network geeks, but they are sort of diplomatic network geeks, because they're all about not just running a network, but connecting one network to another. And because that process is so personal, the best of them really do have this kind of diplomatic streak of sort of recognizing what's necessary to connect their network to the best other network. Sometimes also, of course, paying that other network to connect, becoming a customer, but sometimes really trusting the other network and making it work for other reasons.
Something I love is the notion that the internet comes to Britain through Cornwall, mm-hmm. and these cables through from America to the UK sort of go onto these beaches, and there's one stuff that has just a simple flag over the sea warning fishermen not to go fishing or drop their nets in it. Isn't that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and I mean, it's wonderful to think about. There's my sort of favorite pieces of the internet, because you have this, you know, in one dimension you hold it, it's like a garden hose, it's very small. In the other dimension, it's 3 or 5 or 8,000 miles. It's sort of this impossible to grasp, infinite expanse. Yeah.
And it goes along the seabed all the way across the Atlantic.
You know, it's almost like an underwater railroad track in that it follows the topography underwater to, you know, to make sure it doesn't, you know, isn't suspended anywhere and therefore rubbing and more susceptible to break.
But another one of my favourite anecdotes was that the sharks, when it was first laid, were whipped into such a frenzy that they'd started chewing and then all got electrocuted.
The squirrels of the sea.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so they had to relay it with a special coating.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And have there been any sort of world events that have destabilized or sort of punctured these cables and really, you know, put the boot in for the internet at any time?
Well, the most remarkable story in recent years was when Egypt's internet was shut off. And the folks who sort of examined that what happened actually technically, they could see that each of, I think it was 8 of Egypt's dominant internet service providers were shut off within the course of 4 or 5 minutes. Like, it wasn't just it went dark, but it was this sort of sequence, with the assumption being that there was perhaps a Egyptian government official walking around this one building in Cairo, yanking yellow cables out of routers, or perhaps going down a call list and calling the network engineer at each of these ISPs and saying, okay, pull the plug, pull the plug, pull the plug, you know, one phone call at a time. But what was quite clear is that Egypt's internet predominantly goes through one building in Cairo, and that is the place where this sort of physical disconnecting happened.
And do you think that was a political intervention?
Oh, certainly. Yeah, I mean, quite explicitly. You know, this was an attempt to quell the unrest by disconnecting people from the rest of the world.
Do you think that that's one of the internet's vulnerabilities in the way that it is physical? And we see all this idea of cloud computing. It makes it sound like the internet is a kind of global phenomenon, but actually, as you say, it's being run and funded by real people and businessmen and governments. For instance, in China, who are the people in charge there, and how free is the internet there? And we know there are censorships on it, but in terms of the infrastructure.
Well, I chose not to cross into China saying I want to come look at your critical infrastructure. I thought I was nervous enough about doing that in Germany or here in the UK. I thought doing that in China was not prudent behavior. But that is to say that, you know, certainly the kind of the great firewall, the system in China that has, you know, very successfully you know, censors what it chooses to, depends very much on these physical choke points. Depends very much on a full state control of that. But what's striking is that in the rest of the world, there is no public internet. The internet entirely consists of private networks run by private corporations. And so that creates both, I mean, in a funny way, it's a kind of checks and balances, because you have to, you know, operate your own network in your own self-interest. But because you can't be an island of a network, you have to connect to other networks. You also have to figure out a way of making those connections, and other people are counting on you, and your behavior sort of kept in check because of the need for those connections. So that there's a kind of house of cards idea that each network is operating on its own, but it needs all of the other networks to be a successful inter-network.
And I remember when it was the millennium and everyone said there was going to be a meltdown and that everything was going to go horribly wrong, and that apocalyptic narrative, rather. Is that, you know, ever a possibility for the internet? I mean, can you imagine a sort of global shutdown or something that would really just issue in a kind of absolute chaos?
I think, again, it's this distinction between the logical realm of the internet and the physical realm. And I think, from logically speaking, you know, yes, there could be some sort of cyber attack that breaks the domain name system, you know, that translates web names into the actual IP addresses. And that could have a catastrophic effect on the internet. We could get an error message on our screen. Physically speaking, the internet is actually quite redundant. I mean, physically speaking, while there is a relatively short list of buildings that are the most important, they're quite large, they're quite well protected. There are sort of other ones that are slightly less important that would pick up the slack if something happened. And so I don't, you know, that's that physically, I have quite a bit of faith in it. And then, of course, apocalyptically, there's this wonderful idea that, you know, the internet's a network of networks. You just need 2 new networks to start a new internet.
Well, Andrew, thank you very much for coming in and explaining.
That's my pleasure.
It's a fascinating topic. We could probably spend hours unearthing more cables.
Not cutting them in half.
Yeah. And the new book, Tubes, Behind the Scenes at the Internet, is by Andrew Bloom. We're going to have a very topical song. This is Lonely Notes by the Internet. And that was Lonely Notes by The Internet.
And that brings us to the end of the Monocle Weekly, Sophie. What a show.
It's been fun.
Hasn't it?
And challenging. We were called commie liberals.
I know.
Which we're quite pleased about.
I know. We've learned all about lost art and the inner workings of the internet. I'm not sure if I'm going to look at the internet in the same way.
No, I'm a bit disappointed. I thought it was someone like God in charge.
No, in many ways, I much prefer thinking of it as something that's very much connected underground and hard. I can get my head around all these cables that go onto the Atlantic, even. When you think of it as the cloud, and I still don't really understand what the cloud does, that's when I just get a bit worried.
I know. It's very much like the Wizard of Oz. And you get there, and actually, what's behind it is just a man on a laptop. I'd like to keep the myth alive. Maybe the tubes shouldn't be investigated too much.
You haven't been to the beach in Cornwall where the cables come under, have you?
No, I haven't.
No, it's worth it. It suddenly makes you feel very sort of human, or rather, you think about human achievement, the fact that a cable could even be lain the entire length of the Atlantic and monitored all that way.
That's the communications revolution.
Well, isn't it just? Anyway, that's all from this week's Monocle Weekly. This week's show was produced by Tom Hall and Paul Noble. And it's goodbye from me, Hugo MacDonald.
And goodbye from me, Sophie Grove. Thanks for listening.